Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michael. This, we are part of the Pantheon group of podcasts. This is episode 72. And who is this? Well.
Okay, hi. Well, my name's Dave Oberly, and I'm the drummer, percussionist, and lead vocalist in 70s band Griffin. If you don't know anything about Griffin, we started off as a medieval folk band playing medieval instruments in folk clubs and progressed through that really to become a sort of pretty much full-blown prog rock band. Toured with Yes in America and the UK and still going. And this is actually our 51st year of existence. So we're all a bit long in the tooth.
I must come in there and just, I forgot to tell you that 1974, I joined Transatlantic Records and worked your record.
At that time, Transatlantic was a great label, actually. Yeah. They had some really good artists on it. And, we were very lucky. We were discovered, I think, by Lawrence Aston. I don't know if you knew Lawrence or not. He was in the A&R department at the time, and he heard us play at a club. I think it was the Upstairs Coal Hole in Wimbledon in South London.
Sounds glamorous.
And approached us afterwards, and we just decided, as young impressionable kids as we were then, I think we were around about 19, 20 years old, whatever. So, getting offered a recording deal was pretty amazing. The band had been going for about a year, playing in small clubs and things, and you get to the point where you think, oh, is this actually all worth it? But as it happens, yes, it was. We made five albums in the 70s. Eventually, we left Transatlantic and were signed to Worldwide Artists for management, which was Yes's management, Rick Wakeman, Roger Dean. And it was really through that we ended up signing to EMI Harvest, which was a great label to be on for our last album, which was called Treason. We were produced by a guy called Mike Thorne at the time. And Mike was also responsible for discovering the Sex Pistols and recording them in the basement studios at Manchester Square. Shortly after that, I think things for a lot of bands like us, frog bands and other styles of music, got completely run over by the sort of punk revolution thing. And we got to the point around about 1977 where we just basically thought there's not much point continuing because we weren't getting the audiences And the days of huge huge gigs and dry ice and everybody dressing up in ludicrous costumes or whatever was long gone. People just wanted to go and see a four-piece band with a light bulb hanging over them and throw chairs at them. It was a different world. It was a renaissance at that point, as I'm sure you know. After that, we all went off and went our separate ways. Most of the band continued in music. I moved into working for the music press, and I worked for a weekly paper called Melody Maker. Then moved on to another weekly called Sounds, and after that, I was part of the team that launched the incredibly successful heavy rock mag Kerrang, which was launched out of Sounds. The original editor of Sounds at the time was Alan Lewis. He commissioned Geoff Barton, who then became editor of Kerrang, to get the first issue out. It was launched as a one-off out of Sounds, a giveaway. Within 4 months, 5 months, or whatever, it just took off like a rocket. Within a year, it had overtaken the circulation of the NME, which was again the major paper at the time. And eventually ended up with a worldwide circulation of about 280,000. So very successful. And I think half the success was down to one particular person at that time, who is unfortunately no longer with us, a journalist called Malcolm Dome. Now, Malcolm was very well connected with a lot of the bands that came over, specifically Metallica, actually. He had great contacts with them. What tended to happen with most of the bands that come over, they'd land at Heathrow, come straight to the office. We'd take them out for a drink, or three, or four, and they'd spill the beans on what was really happening with the record label, that sort of thing. So, because of that, we tended to print stories which the major labels didn't necessarily want anybody to know about, the way the bands were being treated, or the fact they hadn't been paid for this or that, or whatever. And we quite often used to get calls from CBS or Atlantic or whatever, just saying, we're pulling our advertising unless you retract these, which we refused to do. And funnily enough, they'd be back within 2 weeks because the power of the magazine was so enormous at that time that they couldn't really afford not to use it. So we had them over a barrel, which was actually quite an interesting situation. But it was great fun, Kerrang. Eventually, it got bought out by a big publishing company called EMAP. And from there on, it sort of went downhill a bit. Although now it's still got its own TV channel, and you can still get it online. It stopped producing physical copies in 2020, mainly because of the pandemic. Things just went a bit pear-shaped at that point for everybody, I think. So I did that for a bit. Then I met up with an old friend, a guy called Tom Doherty, who at the time was working with Motorhead and Girls' School, Tigers of Pantang. And at that time, we decided to launch a heavy rock, heavy metal label, which we call Communique. Did that for 10 years. And then in 2009, Griffin had a gathering, just a meeting of friends. Got back together after that, did a one-off gig at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London on the South Bank, and filled it without doing any publicity at all. It was all word of mouth. So we thought, oh, there's something definitely going on here. We also discovered that a fan had started a website for us. He's an English lecturer at Porto University in Portugal. And we had a quick look at it, and I suddenly looked at the visitor counter, and it was over a quarter of a million. And we thought, my God, there's something going. We knew nothing about it at all. We thought everybody had forgotten us, but far from it. So, moving on from that, we did a small tour after that. That was a few years later. It took a little while to get that together because one of the main guys in the band, a guy called Richard Harvey, was at that time starting to work in the film industry, writing film music. And he was doing a lot of work with Hans Zimmer. So, you know, to try and get him back into the band, you know, yeah, Rich, come back and play with us. We'll pay a couple of grand. Where, you know, he was probably making 200,000 or 300,000 from working with Hans. He left, and we did our first gig without him at the Fairport Conventions Cropperty Festival in Oxford, in front of 25,000 people, which was pretty nerve wracking. Bearing in mind the guy that we had to replace him, we only had 3 weeks rehearsal time. So it was pretty hair-raising. From there on, we've done gigs pretty much all around the country. We've been up and down all over the place. I've recently been to the Netherlands. So it's all going back to sort of international again. The gig scene in the UK is not brilliant at the moment. Lots of venues pretty much disappeared during COVID. You know, unless they were getting help, which a lot of them weren't. So the number of gigs in the UK has definitely gone down, and attendances have also gone down as well. I think people are still, certainly people of my peer group, I mean, I'm in my early 70s now, thinking just a bit, you know, wary about going out still not quite sure. Since then also we've made 2 new albums, so we're up to 7 now. Reinvention was released 4 years ago, I think. And then the latest album, Get Out of My Father's Car, which is probably one of the weirdest titles you'll ever hear for any album, was released 18 months ago. We have some plans at the moment for a new album, but at the moment it's just trying to find the space to do it. 3 of the guys who play with Griffin are full-time pit players in the West End in London, playing in various shows and that sort of thing. So it's difficult to get everybody together because they have to get depths to cover them if they come and do Griffin stuff and that sort of thing. So
it's really interesting to see how you went from folk rock straight into heavy metal, because the way you mentioned all the magazines that might not mean a lot to the people in America, but certainly in the UK, because that's where people found their music, wasn't it? The music papers, they were so influential.
Oh, very much so. I think at the time, as you said, the music press, you know, I know, back in the early 70s or whatever, I always used to grab a copy of Melody Maker because it kept you on top of what was going on. And also the wanted ads, you know, you'd look through those, anybody need a drummer or that sort of thing. I think it was much easier back then for bands. You know, we got away with murder, really. We'd never, ever get signed now to any label because we're not particularly commercial in that respect. Although we have got a very good following, quite a lot in America, funnily enough, which is half the reason I think we ended up on Cruise to the Edge, because the fan base in America represents about 30% of our total fans. So a lot in the UK, of course. But as I said, most of them are our peer group now, really 55 to 70 plus, you know, until they fall off the escalator. but we are beginning to get a whole new generation of people coming up underneath. Since the advent of the record deck coming back, for a lot of young people, we get a lot of messages saying, "Oh, just discovered your first album in my dad's record collection," you know, and it's that sort of thing.
Because it takes you back to a time and a place like nothing else. You know, you might have met your partner at a Griffin gig or something like that. So people feel a great fondness to it. But I do think that the thing is, from what you're saying, it's kind of like it's supply and demand. There's an audience there for if you play. I mean, I always think it's really difficult nowadays starting up because the lack of places that you can go and play. I know venues in Manchester, my hometown, aren't like what they used to be. I'm a great fan of artist development. You know, you pay your dues and you work your way through, and that involves a lot of getting in front of people and playing. Whereas now, I don't think record labels sign you, honestly, to be honest, Dave, unless they have to. You know, if you've got 500,000 followers on Instagram and stuff like that. Days where the scout used to go out 5 nights a week and watch a band coming on at 11 o'clock at night on a Tuesday and then have to go back to the office and report on what he saw. So talent actually has to be thrust in front of them. and a lot of it seeps through the ranks.
It does. It does. I mean, there are a lot of very talented young bands around. I know because I tend to, you know, I'm following a couple, one prog band, young prog band at the moment called Azure. I don't know if you've heard of them. Check them out. They are absolutely phenomenal. But they're struggling. You know, they're struggling to get recognition. They're not signed yet. And it's rather like us now. We don't have a record label. We are our own record label. We formed a company a while ago called Griffin Music Limited, and everything that we bring out under that that banner, because we're all long enough in the tooth now to know how to do it, if you like.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, of course it is, but we'd rather do that and stay in control of what's going on than lose control completely.
Sound advice indeed. You've been listening to Dave Oberly on Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michael. It is part of the Pantheon group of podcasts. Dave will be back telling more stories after this.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
When we first signed to Transatlantic, as I'm sure you may remember, the contracts there, when you signed jointly, severally, and in perpetuity, which basically meant that you gave away everything for the rest of eternity, basically.
How old were you when you signed to Transatlantic?
I was 19, I think. We were around about 19 to 20-ish, around about that.
The trouble with that, though, Dave, is I think like you're very much all in the same bucket, so to speak. You're all kind of, you know, teenage, enthusiastic. You've got a record deal in front of you. You don't think about lawyers and stuff, and you kind of sign your life away, and then you spend half the rest of it trying to get what rightfully is yours back. And it's happened to Leonard Cohen and Sting and plenty.
Oh, absolutely it has. I mean, our catalogue went from Transatlantic Records to Sanctuary Records. It was then bought up by BMG. And we've been trying to get our catalogue back for years. You know, I mean, some of the albums now are 50 years old, but they even making contact with them, they don't want to know. It's of no interest. I got in touch with EMI about Treason probably 4 or 5 years ago, and they wanted 15 grand for the rights to reproduce it. They wouldn't give us the album's back, but they wanted 15 grand to license it. you know, this is our music. And it's like, hang on a minute. But it's the way it is, unfortunately. You know, it's not much you can do about it. But so we just thought, okay, right, well, we'll start our own label and do it all ourselves. Bit of a cottage industry, but we're much happier doing it that way. And it works. It works fine.
Well, you have control. That's the main thing. Do you think, looking back over those years, you know, when you've from a teenager into like your 20s and stuff, are there any particular people, events that happen? So do you have any particular things that in your private moments you sit there and inanely smile out the window, knowing what you're smiling about?
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, there's always one that comes to mind, which is back in 1974 when we were touring with Yes. Well, there are two, in fact. One was playing at Madison Square Gardens in New York. And at the end of our set, there was a huge illuminated sign at the back of the hall saying, "New York welcomes Griffin." And I just thought, that's it, we've made it, you know, as you would. I mean, we were, you know, early 20s then. So to have something like that happen was pretty amazing. And the second one is, during that whole tour, we probably heard Yes play 35 times live. It's a long tour. And towards the end of the tour, we were actually quite good friends with them. At that point, I played on Steve Howe's solo albums, Beginnings, which also Graham played on, Graham, our guitarist. And Brian was very good friends with John Anderson. And we used to end up, I think, on the last three dates of the tour, we used to go on and do their encores with them. I think it was Heart of the Sunrise and Roundabout with the two pieces. So that was great, you know, actually. Because we'd idolised Yes from way, way back, actually, probably early 70s. I mean, I was into Yes before I even joined Griffin, really. It was around about the same time. And the rest of the band were very heavily into them, as well as bands like Caravan and, you know, the whole Canterbury scene that was going on at the time. There were some really good bands about.
Did you have the support of the record company, or did Yes invite you onto those tours?
Oh, Yes invited onto it. We were actually billed. It was actually billed as Yes and their friends Griffin.
Brilliant.
Which
good on
which
that,
was quite an accolade anyway. But half the reason that happened, it was down to one person, really. It was really John Anderson, and more so was Rick Wakeman. Because Rick and Brian from Griffin and Richard from Griffin were all at the Royal College of Music at the same time. So they knew Rick from there. And Rick was and still is a huge Griffin fan anyway. So really, I think, you know, us getting signed to Yes's management was influenced by both John and by Rick. So grateful to them for that, because otherwise we might still be playing in folk clubs. Or not playing at all.
No, that's fantastic, because I go back to, you know, when I was working out on the road with David Bowie, you know, I mean, in periods in his career, I mean, he invited like both the Pixies and Nine Inch Nails. And Bowie's very much known for kind of making experimental kind of change of direction albums. And he wasn't like the front page of the music press. So to have somebody that would be prepared to not only put you on as the support act, knowing that you created a huge buzz, what would also stand at the side of the stage and watch your set? I mean, what would you feel like watching David Bowie watching you play?
Nervous, probably. I don't know. I mean, the thing is, I've always found this, you know, you come face to face with your idols, you know, from years back or whatever. And over the years, lots of people I've met that I've followed from an early time, and it's when you come to the inevitable conclusion that actually they're just people, just like you. They have talent, yes, they do, but they've still got the same problems and the same hang-ups, and you know, however much they've got or however successful they've been, they're just people, the same as all the rest of us. And I think once you get through that, it makes life a lot easier talking to somebody like that, because you don't tend to revere them. As such, you know, you'll just talk to them as normal people. And I think most people in that situation actually really appreciate that. You know, the fact that they're not held up as some huge, great icon. They get that all the time.
Yeah.
I think what's probably really nice is when people don't actually know who you are and talk to you. I've had that happen a couple of times. And you know, they've eventually said, oh, well, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a drummer. You know, and who do you play with? Griffin. What, the Griffin? and that, it's almost like they take a step backwards. And that's really quite bizarre. I get a bit shy when that sort of thing happens, so, you know.
Yeah, I got a quick thing to share with you. Sometimes you get the odd quirky ones. I interviewed Ian McNabb from the Icicle Works, you know, and supported Brian Wilson in his hometown. You know, well, what can be better than that? He did it with Neil
Young. Absolutely.
So I made a point of going over to Brian Wilson before he went on stage and said, oh, Mr. Wilson, I'm a great fan of music. I just wanted to introduce myself and thank you so much, you know. And he was really surprised, Ian said, that he reached out his hand to shake it. And he reached out his hand, shook his hand and went, security, security.
I love it. Absolutely love it.
And he said then, so it's not always great to meet your heroes.
No, it isn't. It isn't, actually. But, yeah, I mean, as I said, that sort of thing's happened to me before. But a certain member of Led Zeppelin I met at Cropredy. And I wanted to, you know, just go over and say hello. I went over and I said, I love your music, my music. My name's Dave. I play in a band called Griffin. He took my hand, shook it, and he said, we all have our cross to bear. He said,
are you going to share who it was?
No. You can guess.
I mean, I love groups that really come through a grassroots level because it brings out not just the artist in you, but the persistence, the resilience to keep going. Because, you know, sometimes you walk in a venue and, you know, you're tired and, you know, you've got to kind of get in a little van and drive 4 hours to your next gig. But that's what I call paying your dues.
It is. And we're still doing it.
Yeah, exactly. We're repaying your dues.
Yeah, it's not sex and drugs and rock and roll anymore now. It's after the gig, back to the hotel, a nice cup of Horlicks and go to bed.
The other thing to remember is the fact that you are now in control of your own career. So at least whatever you're doing is a band decision and not people overseeing it. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's anxiousness and anxiety and then you've got to go on stage and play.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. It sort of works much better for us. I've always believed there are three elements to being successful. One is courage, two is tenacity, and three is blind stupidity. If you've got those three, you'll be able to get through anything.
Yeah.
Courage to do it in the first place, tenacity to keep at it, and blind stupidity that is going to work.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a great lesson for yourself, isn't it? Because the thing is, you are now going back and you sound like you're enjoying it as much as you ever did. Because the thing is, like, it's for fun as much as like entertainment for the others.
Oh, absolutely. And also, you know, I'm very lucky to be playing in a band that has such incredibly talented players in it. All the band are just brilliantly good at what they do. You know, the art has been honed over the last 50 years. So if they can't play by now, then there's a bit of a problem, but they can. And they're a great bunch of guys. It's become more of a family now. You know, we all socialize and keep in touch. And the humor that existed in Griffin right from the beginning on stage, we've always kept that. That's still going now. You know, if something happens on stage, then somebody misses something or whatever, and we all rip the piss out of them for about 2 minutes. And the audience love it. It makes them laugh, and it makes us real. You know, my wife has often said, if you want to hear an album play perfectly, then listen to the record.
Yeah.
You know, live is a different animal. It's a totally different animal.
I also remember watching some stuff, both David Bowie said it and Rick Rubin, who's really kind of, you know, a genius in production and things like, and knows nothing about other than the creative side. And he says, never make a record for other people, make it for yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. I think that's also why, you know, with us, I mean, we are perfectionists. It does take a while for us to get everything right, but once you make a record, it's there forever. That's how it is. And if there are things on it that you don't like, once it's out, there's nothing you can do about it. It's there for, you know, perpetuity. That it's not going to suddenly change because you don't like that bit. Not unless you go back and remix it all, you know, which some bands have done. But it's a moment in time, I think. Rather like, you know, it's rather like, I suppose, the film industry, where with a film you can have as many takes as you want to get something right. But in a theatre, a live performance, you've got one shot and that's it. And it's the same with music. You know, the live performance of music, you've got that one shot. With an album, you can take as long as you like putting it all together. So there are definitely comparisons there between film and music.
It's interesting that you've seen different sides of the business, because to be kind of, you know, going into the music press and kind of making that work successfully and understanding, like, you know, how... I mean, the other thing is I find that with, you know, with a lot of artists and stuff, the fact that you've been there and done that, there's more trust involved, isn't there? Because a lot of musicians, they kind of feel they're going to get screwed over by the press, because you can sit there having a few beers in a two-hour interview in a pub and they'll pick up on the one thing that is a headline, because they're there to sell papers.
Yes, quite. You're right. You know, I have got a wardrobe. In fact, two wardrobes full of T-shirts to coin a phrase. I have plenty of T-shirts. But yeah, you're right. It's sort of, I think, particularly with Kerrang, I think it was always, you know, that feeling that we wanted people to hear what was really going on rather than what they were being told was going on. And we were probably one of the few mags at the time that ever did that. And I think because of that, because the word got out quite quickly, the readers that we had stuck with us and bought more in, because we told it how it was rather than, you know, as I said, sort of, you know, record company press releases, which we didn't always take much note of. The thing these days is, I think, you know, it's... Media is so different now. The printed media has almost disappeared anyway, so everything is online. We're actually finding now, just as an aside, that we're probably selling... we use Bandcamp for streaming, and we're selling as many albums through Bandcamp as we are physical CDs, so the whole profile is beginning to change now. Still, the old school, you know, the hardcore still want CDs and vinyl. We produced vinyl of the last album. I think we manufactured 500, 750, and they sold out in 2 days. All gone.
So it's a quote, Mr. Tom Rush, no regrets.
No, absolutely. We'll keep going for as long as is humanly possible. I think until, you know, physically we can't do it, but... There again, I look around at other bands that are in their late 70s, early 80s, and they're still going. So as long as I can physically still drum, then I'll do it.
I love it, Dave. That's so great to hear. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on. Brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant. Thank you, sir.
That's a brilliant idea. And I think the way that you're steering this and doing it is brilliant. It's relaxed. And interesting, and it's nice having those interjections coming in as well, so you're not just listening to somebody, you know.
Thank you so much. I might have to edit this bit and put it back into the interview. Compliments, you know.
Love it. Great guy doing what he loves. Dave Oberly, who started off in Griffin. Would you believe, I think I said at the beginning, I actually sold that record when I was working for Transatlantic in 1974. So here we are, 50 years later, talking about all that stuff. And sharing other experiences through his career, the influence of people like Rick Wakeman and Yes had on the band, and of course his time in Kerrang, which was a phenomenally successful magazine. Articles with lots and lots of the big rock stars and up and coming ones as well. I don't know if it was successful in the US, but certainly in the UK. Anyway, you have been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides, and as I said, today's guest, Dave Oberly. Stay tuned for more to come up next week. Subscribe, review, and come back for more. Thank you so much.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.